Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everybody, I'm Carl Hansel. I'm the editor of Greenkeeper International for Bigger, and I'd like to welcome you to this Continue to Learn Extra webinar today. Today, we bring together a panel of Bigger members and supporters who have all experienced COVID-19 firsthand. We'll talk about their battle against the virus and how they see it changing our industry for years to come. So if I may introduce our panelists. Jez Hughes is the International Business Development Manager for Symbio. Prior to joining Symbio in 2015, he was a greenkeeper, spending 27 years at Vale of Llangollen Golf Club, 20 years as course manager. He's an avid supporter of Bigger and served on both section and region boards before completing a term as a director on the national board. He also plays golf to a high standard, representing his club, county and North Wales. Les Hawkins is course manager at the Richmond Golf Club in Surrey. He has 30 years of experience in the greenkeeping industry, achieving his Master Greenkeeper certificate in 2004. He's a past chairman of Bigger, a regular presenter at Continue to Learn at BTME, and he also presents at the Future Turf Managers Initiative. And recently, he's rejoined the Surrey Section Committee as chairman. Phil Collinson is ICL's Technical Area Sales Manager for the Northwest of England. Phil has 17 years of experience working in the turf industry, initially spending almost 10 years at Rochdale AFC as head groundsman. He's been in his role with ICL for just over 5 years now, where he's gained both basis and facts qualifications. His day-to-day duties include advising on ICL products to both distributors and end users, as well as being involved in research trials whenever the opportunity arises. Okay, for anybody that's listening out there, please feel free to ask questions via the chat function that can be found at the bottom of your screen, and we will pose questions to our panel on your behalf. Okay, let's get cracking. I'm really interested to hear about this, you guys. All three of you actually were struck down with coronavirus at some point over the last few months. It's our worst fears, many of us, none more so than when you've got a young family. And so I'm going to come to Phil first. Can you just tell me, Phil, a little bit about your story?
Yeah, so I was one of the early cases, I guess. So I got struck down early March, and it was on a Monday afternoon. I was going about my meetings as Jez will be doing, I guess, in his role as well. And I was seeing customers through the day, and as the day progressed, I started to get a bit of a headache, which is unusual for me. You know, quite a fit and healthy individual, really. And by the evening, the cough was starting to come, and certainly by 24 hours later, starting to develop some of the key symptoms that we're hearing about at the time, the cough, the fever. And things just kept getting worse, really. And by another 48 hours later, so kind of the Wednesday night, early Thursday morning, woke up at 1 o'clock in the morning and really having to concentrate on my breathing. And obviously, with your mind starts saying, this is probably COVID-19. But at the time, it was very much the messaging that my understanding was that if you're under 60 and you've got no underlying health issues, you might have kind of mild symptoms for a few days, but you've really got not a huge amount to worry about. But by that time, when I was starting to concentrate on breathing, my wife, who was next to me, said, you better go on the 111 website. And it was kind of multiple choice. So have you got a fever? Have you got headaches? Have you struggling with your breathing? And at the end of it, the kind of scary thing that comes up on your phone is call an ambulance. I've never had to call an ambulance in my life. And you can imagine, like you said before, a young family. I've got an 11-month-old daughter. The kind of worst things rush through your head as you sat there waiting for the ambulance to turn up. And it was a surreal situation. You know, I was sat in my kitchen. I've got a wonderful NHS worker there, all with the PPE on in your front room, in your kitchen, sorry, with linked up to an ECG, checking my heart was fine. And yeah, you look across to your wife and your child and you start thinking, this shouldn't be happening to me. I'm 36, pretty healthy. And you know, the NHS, whilst they didn't do a test there and then they weren't testing, was very much the same. Look, you kind of exactly what we're seeing with COVID-19, but you're 36, you're healthy. There's not a hospital bed for you. Battle through it with water and paracetamol, which is what we did for another 4 or 5 days. And I think if you look through the timeline of COVID, you see quite a few could maybe recover after 5 or 6 days. And certain, for whatever reason, I don't think they know yet, but kind of day 7, day 8, you kind of drop off the cliff again and develop pneumonia. And that's exactly what happened to me. I remember on the Friday or Saturday night, now I was starting to feel better. We ordered the Domino's. We thought, we're over this. and the morning after, I just plummeted again. And by the Sunday evening, I was in a really bad way, to the point where my wife, again, phoned an ambulance. We were struggling to breathe. We were nausea. I've think in the past 15 years, I've had 1 or 2 days off ill. I'm just never ill. So this was totally bizarre to us that I was in this way, really. An ambulance came out again. This time they were a lot more concerned about me, but because it was so early on, there's no hospital bed for people that are 36 and healthy, you know, just keep battling through it. Fortunately, by day 14, 15, I was coming out the other side. Still wasn't in great shape, but at least I felt I'd improved a bit. And then it took me maybe 3.5 weeks to get rid of all the symptoms. I had the no smell, the no taste, you know, all the things you read about as being typical. And it was bizarre having no taste. I had a banana, ate the banana, ate the pizza, tasted exactly the same. How weird is that? And then, the sense of smell. The moment I got my smell back was when I was changing a dirty nappy of all the times to get your smell back. Like, you could not make it up. But yeah, I was just glad to get that back. But no, a really worrying time. And I suppose, again, it was at the early stages, and you could see on the news that maybe people weren't taking it as serious as what they are doing now. And it was worrying to see. If it could happen to me, a fairly healthy person, then I was texting my mate saying, look, you need to take this seriously. You need to stop going out there. And I guess eventually over time, that we are where we are now, and people are taking it a lot more seriously.
Now, you mentioned you got an 11-month-old child running around the house. This is a highly contagious, we're led to believe it's a highly contagious disease. What goes through your head when on that first day when you're ill and the ambulance is there? Do you tell your wife and your child to stay away? You know, don't come anywhere near me.
I suppose when the ambulance was coming, they were in the same room with me. However, from that point, when we were lucky enough that we've got kind of 2 showers in our house and I could quite easily self-isolate. But yeah, I didn't see, I kind of saw my child from maybe 5-10 meters away, but I certainly didn't touch, hug. And any fathers out there will know that those early months, all you want to do is pick them up and play with them. And it was, that was really hard. Hard on my wife as well. I think she had a really rough time of it, looking after me, looking after herself and looking after the baby as well. It took a huge toll on her. We believe that she had some symptoms and she might just be a bit fitter than me and managed to get through it a bit easier. But until we get the antibody test, I guess we won't know for sure. So obviously we're still really concerned now whether she'll catch it. But you know, it was scary times, you know, but we managed to self-isolate for 2 weeks. And fair play to Sophie for putting up with me and looking after Pia during those 2 weeks.
Oh, brilliant. Jeremy, let's go to you. Let's hear your story. I know it's quite similar to some extent in terms of self-isolating away from your family for a period of time.
Yeah, and that was quite interesting. Obviously, we've not spoke before, and listening to Phil's experience there, you know, I can relate to so much. You know, mine actually was a Monday as well. It was the end of March, the 30th. We'd already been off the road a bit, really, from being able to go out and see people. And we were just starting to do a little bit of video conferencing and different things. And I'd had a couple on that day. That evening, I just didn't feel quite right. I just felt a bit achy and a bit tired. And then the Tuesday, it really kicked in with me. I knew then, obviously, I was hot, I was sweating, I was trying to work in my little office, and you could feel, you know, the fact that I was aching across the back of my neck. And I thought then, this doesn't feel right. I'd had a tough infection, well, a tough removed, and first of all, I thought it was related to that, but we'd cleared the living room where we were going to decorate. Funny enough, on the Sunday, I'd put things back together. Because of working from home, it wasn't easy. I've got three children who were also trying to homeschool. So I said, we need some separate space. And I moved into that room because, you know, I wanted to protect the family. My wife works in the ICU, actually, at the hospital. And I proceeded to stay in there. I had the patio doors onto the garden, and I had the downstairs toilet. So I was delivered some food, cleaning touch points and everything else. Now, by the following Tuesday, which is pretty much a week, I would say I didn't feel too bad. I didn't really notice a loss of smell. I didn't really have a cough. But the taste was funny because everything, I had this sort of funny cross between a metallic and a soapy taste. So nothing was tasting as it should do. And that obviously was quite strange. A severe pain across sort of the top of your nose, as if there's a lot of pressure there, but not like a congestion cold or anything like that. So obviously we weren't 100% sure, but it did feel like there was a lot of things that people were talking about on the TV. And like I say, I got through to the Tuesday and I thought, I don't feel too bad. Wednesday, I actually left the house and went for a walk with my wife, only locally. Thursday morning, I went for a little ride on my bike. And then the Friday morning, which was actually Good Friday, I left the house. And as soon as I left the house, I going on my bike, thought I'd go a bit further. I've got to build myself back up, you know, I've been ill. And I could feel I was just struggling with breathing a bit. And I thought, well, it's, you know, you're unfit. You've had, you know, a week lying around. And I carried on to try and push myself a little bit. And that was probably, you know, the worst thing I could have done. I got somewhere near home and I realized I was really, really struggling. And as I came up the hill to by me, it was apparent I just couldn't get breath. And it was very scary. From my point of view, I was lucky enough. I had a CPAP machine, which is one of the ones I'd seen on telly that they were using in hospitals. I had that machine because of sort of some sleep apnea years ago. I was overweight and I used to smoke 30, 40 cigarettes a day and 18 stone. So I'd been using it because I was struggling sometimes with breath, you know, through that week, previous week. So I managed to get to the house, put my bike down, take my t-shirt off, and being at the patio doors, I was able to just sit there for half an hour without machine. Now to me, where I was at that day, my wife wasn't here, the children were in bed, it was early morning. There was no ambulance going to get to me in time. And I do feel that machine did, you know, save my life then on that day.
Wow.
Shit. Yeah.
What's it like in terms of you can't breathe? I mean, I'm name drop myself here. I did a Everest base camp trek November last year, and there's no air up there, there's no oxygen, but you're breathing and you're not getting any energy. You know, it's a real weird feeling. What yourself and Philip both mentioned being unable to breathe. What was it like? Did you feel?
What was I that think feeling like? There's probably a little bit of panic and anxiety in it as well. So anyone, I suppose anyone who suffers with asthma or has had pneumonia will probably be able to relate to it. It was like, as you were trying to control your breathing, it wasn't getting any better. And then as you were trying to get a breath, there was nothing there. So it was like, as almost as if you were drowning in effect, but it was the fact you had no oxygen. So that day, obviously I knew something wasn't right. But again, there was no way I wanted to go to hospital because the people I seen going to hospital on telly weren't coming back. So again, stayed on the sofa over the weekend. I took everything quite easy. And on the Monday, I thought, I don't feel too bad again. I'll go for a little walk. And I didn't get very far. And the same thing again. I was really struggling to get breath. Luckily, a girl next door was walking the other way, and she actually sort of followed me home. And I got back on my CPAP machine, and I used that quite a bit during Monday because I was struggling quite a bit. That was the day we phoned the doctor, and we had a video call, and he said, "You're going to have to come to the surgery." And I couldn't go in. I had to meet him outside, stay in the car. He had to come out with his gown and his mask and everything on. And he took my oxygen level, and that was 79%. But he tried to do two hands because obviously outside he was struggling a bit. And we had an 83 and a 79. So he said, "It doesn't matter which one we look at, you know, they're low. And we're going to have to phone the hospital." So he phoned the hospital. I waited in the car. He phoned back and he said, "Unfortunately, don't panic, but you're going to have to go in." And to be fair, that was probably the scariest time because I came home and I got my bag. And I go out through the patio doors and, you know, I can't hug or kiss any of the children. And I'm having to say, "Tara," and we're watching the TVs and everything. Are you coming back? You don't know, you know, and it's not nice for anyone. But I was lucky enough, went to the hospital, like Phil said, they've done a lot of tests, ECG, everything, checked my chest. And the consultant said that he wasn't going to admit me. You know, the fact that it was 99% that I'd had the COVID virus, same as the doctor, they wouldn't do the chest x-ray or the test unless they admitted me. And with me having a machine at home and where I was at, my oxygen levels had come back up. I was safer to be at home than sat in the ICU. So much to my wife's maybe annoyance, I don't know, but surprise, she got a phone call to come and pick me up. So yeah, to come back home was fantastic on the same day. They'd already told me that, you know, it could get a little bit worse, to take it easy. And if it was bad again, obviously I had to phone 999. Yeah. So that was bank holiday Monday now. So Tuesday, I did a little bit. I've done a few phone calls. I've done a few emails and wasn't too bad. Wednesday, probably done a little bit more and was talking a lot on the phone with a lot of people. Maybe a couple of stressful phone calls. But when I got to the afternoon, I knew I didn't feel well at all. My wife came home, and this was 3 o'clock, half past three. And I said to her, I'd already phoned the office and told them I didn't feel very well. And they said, "Oh, just, you know, just sort of take it easy later on in the day." But I just felt worse and worse. I had my mask on, but I was going very cold. My fingers were blue, and my wife was sitting holding my hand. And I'd sort of said to her, "You're going to have to call an ambulance." And they took what seemed quite a while to come. But and then they put all the protective clothing and everything on. And again, obviously my children are in the house, they're in the window, and the neighbours. And the ambulance came. They were here for about half an hour. And again, obviously they went through similar with all the sort of ECG tests, so everything. My oxygen levels were actually quite good. Their information was that, you know, I was safer at home again, but I've got to really start to understand that I need to take it quite easy. So again, that was it on the Wednesday. So then, yeah, I would say then I spent 3 weeks in self-isolation. Yeah. And I would say the next 2 weeks was quite difficult. I had to be careful, and I was, for someone who's quite a confident person, I did suffer a little bit with anxiety and panic about going out then for a couple of weeks. Because you just think about oxygen. And I suppose it was week 6 and 7 when I actually started feeling pretty good and pretty normal. So the fact that we could work from home, you know, through that period was quite good, because it just meant we weren't out doing anything. But very, very scary. And I feel happy to be here today speaking to you all. So they're similar but different right across the board, I think, with a lot of these.
Yeah, scary story, like you say. Les, hearing you're, I believe, the only one on this panel that actually was tested and actually proved positive for coronavirus. So that in itself is interesting. But in terms of listening to Jez's and Phil's story, where does that resonate with you? And how does it reflect upon your own experiences?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of similarities. But by listening, I think I got away lightly compared to these two. You know, mine started mid-March. I'd been at the FTMI doing the budgeting workshop and drove home from Ipswich, which is, you know, 2.5 hour drive back from there. Felt fine. Sat watching TV at night, 9:30. Thought, oh, my feet are freezing. Got up to go to bed, and it was literally like being hit with a shovel. It was, you know, everything started aching as soon as I got up, my knees, my elbows, my feet, everything. So I got into bed. So I went to sleep, woke up in the middle of the night. I think my wife maybe even woke me up, and I was absolutely just dripping with sweat. She took my temperature, it was 40, and it's like, oh my word. So, you know, do the usual thing. I'll be all right in the morning. A couple of paracetamols or Nurofen, as it was, which you shouldn't have taken. I got up in the morning because obviously I live on site, walked across the car park, shouted at the lads across the yard, you know, I don't feel great. I'm not going to come near you. Literally went back to bed, and I didn't get out of bed again then for 13 days. You know, so that was on the Thursday night. So on the Sunday, say the breathing thing, it was almost like a pant. And you know, when we did have to get an ambulance out, my wife had called the 111 and talking to sort of like a medic on the end of the line and asked all these different questions. And then it was like, can you stick your tongue out? And I went, And my wife shouted at me. She went, he said, stick your tongue out. I went, my tongue out. And I couldn't do it. And I couldn't speak. And everything like in my throat and at the back had just like closed. It was just like swollen. And the medic on the phones went, there's an ambulance on its way. If you've got an antihistamine tablet, take it now. I was like, oh, right. And then it's like, when he says, no, there's an ambulance on the way, you like panic. I'm not a panicker by nature, but even I was like, oh, hang on a minute, this is quite serious. So, you know, a bit like you, Jez, they came and did the tests, and I thought my blood oxygen was low. It wasn't as low as yours. Mine was 87%. It meant nothing to me at the time, but since then, I'm talking to a member at the golf club here who's a doctor, and he was like, oh, no, he said anything less than 90 is, you know, pretty serious. I stayed at home, you know, relatively young, 45, 46, reasonably healthy lifestyle. Thanks, Carl, I saw that. fairly sort of healthy lifestyle. Like, you know, I don't get colds, I don't get the flu, I don't get migraines, I just don't get ill. I mean, this was my first days off sick since 2007. You know, so it was just shocking. But so I had that one day with the ambulance, really struggling to breathe. But it kind of like, it got a bit better the next day. And, you know, the doctor, we had a doctor on call sort of thing, and he phoned me 3 days on the trot just to see how it was going, just monitoring the situation. Everything hurt, you know, my chest hurt, it hurt to breathe. My elbows, my knees, it was like flu-like symptoms, but it was like my knees were in a vice. It was horrible, and I just couldn't move. And you know, we live in a flat on the golf, you know, in the middle of the golf course, and it's one floor, and to get from my bed to the bathroom is maybe 10 yards, and just to walk to go to the loo and then walk back just left me absolutely beaten. It was like I needed sleep. You know, that's how tired it was. And that went on for 13 days. But once the recovery started, it happened really quick. I mean, Jez said, you know, he went for a walk and felt bad again and then tried it again. I literally did nothing for 13 days and then sat there in the afternoon, thought, I don't feel too bad. I'm gonna have a shower. So I went and had a shower. Instead of putting my pajamas back on and getting back into bed, I actually put on a pair of jeans, t-shirt, some socks, and sat on the sofa and put Countdown on or whatever it was. And that made me feel better. and it could just feel life coming back into my body. It was really strange feeling. It was just happening as I was sat there. And at 6:30 at night, obviously the golf course was closed and there was no one here. And my wife and kids have been having a walk around every night just to get sort of like out of the house, keep away from everyone, sort of thing. And I just went, I'm going to go for a walk. She went, what? I went, yeah. So I got up and I walked. And anyone that's been to Richmond Golf, I walked to the archway and back. It's maybe 0.5 mile. And even just getting out in the fresh air made me feel better. But why was I tired at the end of that? I mean, that was I'm off to bed now. But the next day, just woke up, felt even better still. Again, went for a walk. And then on the Friday, I went back to work. So 15 days after starting the whole thing, the recovery to get me from bedridden to going back to work was 2 days. And, it was another 5 weeks after that, really, before all the symptoms had disappeared. Couldn't do anything too strenuous. And, the greenkeepers out there will say, I was trying to change the height on a rotary deck. It's a couple of pins. It takes 15, 20 seconds. And I started trying to do it and I couldn't. I was like panting. I was out of breath and I physically felt tired. So I just put everything down and went, someone else will have to do it. And, so I literally just stuck to driving around on a buggy and, making sure everything was okay and doing nothing strenuous at all. Like the guy say, thankful that I'm still here. Thankful to the staff at the NHS. And my wife, for looking after me, was amazing. So
brilliant. Now you're all, guys that get out and about a lot. Les, you're active in your job as a greenkeeper, and you guys, you're driving around the country. What's it like? All three of you have said that you're in bed for basically 2 weeks with what is a deadly disease. What goes through your head over those 2 weeks? And are you worried? Is this going to get worse?
For me, Cal, it was, and Jez may well be the same here, that we do have jobs where we're going out to many different workplaces. We'll have seen many different people in the weeks or the days leading up to when you get the symptoms. And for me, that first week of lying there was, who else have I possibly infected? There might have been 20, 30 guys that I'd have seen in that kind of 10-day period where they're saying you can carry it and not know it and maybe transfer it on. So that was really scary. Obviously, my work was great. We have a system where you can see exactly who we've seen before and they can get in contact with all those guys to make them aware, and they did that really as quick as they could do, which was great. It took that weight off my mind a little bit. But on the Sunday night, so 2 days before I started seeing symptoms, I'd seen my mum and dad, who would have been in that high-risk category, 70 years plus. So for that first week, I was just hoping my phone doesn't go and that one of my parents has got it, where, God knows what would happen if those guys got it. So lying in bed whilst it was a battle, kind of dealing with the symptoms, lucky enough that the wife was dropping food at the door and I was getting fed and watered. Not that I ate much. I think I had about 2 bars. I lost 7 kilograms in 10 days. So I was looking the best I'd ever looked, to be fair. But no, it really was that worry about, have I passed it on to anyone else?
Yeah.
It was the biggest one for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're, like, as you said, you're 36, you're the younger of young and healthy relatively, and you older guys, do you fear that you're going downhill? What goes through your head? Les, there's a lovely picture of you tucked up in bed, you look cozy, but I imagine that's not the case.
Yeah, it was because the first couple of days, I mean, like the first day after I got ill, I thought, all right, is this coronavirus? My first thought was, right, I need to give Jim Croxton a call, because obviously I've been at FTMI. Mm-hmm. I just thought, blimey, I could wipe out like a couple of dozen, young up and coming greenkeepers here. And that feeling wasn't very nice at all. I felt quite guilty about that, the prospect of, potentially infecting so many people. And obviously Sammy was there and Jim and, some of the staff from Ransoms as well. So yeah, that was literally in the first 24 to 36 hours, but beyond that, I really didn't think of anything. I mean, I had days where I was kind of hallucinating, and nothing really made any sense at all. And the most bizarre thing ever was every time I shut my eyes, I panicked about where my glass of water was, and I had this feeling that I was in the middle of a desert. And I'd open my eyes, grab my glass, take a drink, put it down, and then I'd shut my eyes out. And to the point I'm lying there going, right, I know where I am. I know I'm in my bed. I know my glass is there. Just stop it now. And I couldn't. It just kept coming back into my mind every time. And so for days and days and days, couldn't really think straight at all. You know, so it was a bit strange, really strange sort of feeling to go through that.
Yeah, that's all. Was that? Did you get any hallucinations at all, Jez? Because I got one.
Yeah, that's where it's so strange now, listening to that now. Obviously, going back to the travel and that, I was traveling quite a lot of Europe, but I'd been back since the 11th. So it was like 19, 20 days where I hadn't been abroad, but I had seen some people in the UK, but we were sort of told not to venture out from about the 23rd when they started, you know, closing things down. So I was like, well, this is a week that I've been at home. So a little bit scary, you know, who had I seen, where they'd been. And I suppose after the first 3 or 4 days where I didn't really feel too good about anything, I did start, you know, speaking to people I'd been abroad with. They were all okay. People I'd been in this country with, you know, they were pretty much all okay. And it was... you know, that was a relief, you know, but for me, where did I get it? How did I get it? You know, that we'll never know. But going back to what Les just said now and what you've just said, yeah, some of the strangest dreams I've ever had in my life, good ones and bad ones, and some hallucinations in effect. But with Les, with your drink and your water, when I said I couldn't leave the house and I couldn't do things, the only thing I could do when I did start was I had to have this bottle of ice cold water. And when I panicked or when I was thinking about something, I had to start sipping cold water. And obviously the change in mindset that was with me was the drinking of the cold water and panicking if I didn't have it with me. So similar to what you were experiencing, Les, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I had one hallucination, and I've only told my close family this one because it's so bizarre. So why I'm saying it now on a webinar that's being recorded, I don't know. But you'll all have seen Toy Story with the main characters Woody and Buzz Lightyear.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I was watching that, and they were literally fighting on my chest. And I was watching it, and I was like, pinching, and I could literally see. It's just bizarre what happens in your head. I don't know why those characters were in my head. I've not watched it for years. Whatever, it just came in my head, and I was watching these two characters fight away.
Were you awake?
Yeah, I was watching it. Yeah, I was awake. Just the hallucinations going on in my head.
Yeah.
Bizarre. Wow. Yeah, wow. I'm not talking anything. Just paracetamol. Yeah. I was seeing all sorts.
I don't know where to go from that.
No, that's a bit of a bit of an odd one.
I'm not going to tell you mine at all.
Although, like the guys will know, that night and day just kind of blend into one. You don't get any sleep. Yeah. I think I must have had maybe, I was lucky if I got an hour and a half, 2 hours sleep consecutively before I was waking up, and either freezing cold or boiling hot. The thermostat was going from like 26 down to like just being off and the windows being open. It was, I think it was daytime, but it could have been.
Again, for any of you guys, when you won't have been completely out of touch, you know, you'll have heard the news, etc., with the massive death tolls that have come because of this. When you're in the center of that and you're fighting this disease yourself, what goes through your head when you hear about the latest death toll? Do you think to go?
I think for me, the time I spent there, and I was in the living room, so obviously I had access to the TV. For me, probably watched too much TV. In some respects, it made me think more about death and the fact what is happening inside, what when's it going to end? But I think it also helped me in effect of some of the things I did with my CPAP and different things about, you know, trying to stay at home for me was safer. But I think it worked both ways. But yeah, you certainly do have those thoughts that, you know, these people, there's that many people that have got this that have not recovered. And for me, the second part of it was what's actually happening inside. When's it going to stop? You know, is it going to get worse or will it get better?
Phil?
So I guess I was some ways lucky that I was right at the start. I got it the weekend just after Cheltenham. So sporting events were still going on. I think they were at the point where they were going to start shutting them down and closing things down. And at the time, it was when you're 36, you're going to be fine. Just take your water, take your paracetamol. So the thoughts going through my head was, I'll beat this. You know, it's only the number, the stats were showing that I'll be fine. I had an 11-month, like we said. But babies, one good thing about this, I guess, is that it doesn't seem to affect babies and young children very much. So that was the saving grace, I guess, from that side of things. Yeah, so my main worry was other people, really. It was my parents and people that I'd seen that would have been higher risk. So maybe ignorance was bliss at that point. That I was young, though. I was going to get through this.
Okay, all right. Les, after, you know, you said you, after a couple of weeks, you started recovering. How did you get back to work? When did you make that decision to see your family and then start the process of going back to work? How does that happen? Are you nervous? Where does it go?
Maybe a little bit different for me, because I live on site and you know, so like work and home life kind of blend into one, essentially. There is no going home time. It's that, you know, going back to work was a little bit different. But I mean, right through the 2 weeks of the bed being bedridden, my wife was at my side. The kids basically refused to stay away from me. You know, they came in for their cuddle at night before they went to bed, and even though we told them not to, they still did. So I'd still had that sort of integration with my close family. Still haven't seen anyone outside my family since. Looking to try and perhaps go and see my mum at some point in the next couple of weeks, but obviously the weather's got to be half decent because we're not allowed in the house, which is fine. But yeah, I mean, getting back to work, you know, the lads knew what had happened. We'd already sort of like instigated some fairly rigorous cleaning and, you know, good practice at work. You know, everything was being disinfected, no sharing machines, you know, only one person allowed on a gator at a time. And, you know, so it looked strange to have everyone working separately, but we got into that. And as I say, for the first couple of weeks, I literally just drove around on a golf buggy, making sure that the lads were all right. You know, because, you know, this, the whole lone working thing, I've only got a little site, it's only 104 acres, but, you know, I always sort of like worried that, you know, are they okay? So I literally just drove around. I'm sure they thought I was checking up on them to make sure they were working, but genuinely wasn't. It was more of a, you know, you're okay. So, but yeah, I mean, it was a fairly seamless sort of like drift back into work for me. I know I'm lucky. Living where I live and working where I work, and that side of it was good. But as I say, some of the jobs that I would normally have just done, I just didn't do. So, you know, I just had to palm them off onto my deputy Ben, who was brilliant. Actually, he did a fantastic job in my absence, and even when I was back, he took a fair bit of the burden as well. So it's been all right.
Yeah, Ben, who was at TPC Sawgrass, wasn't he?
He was actually there when I got ill, and they abandoned it on the Thursday. That was the day I got ill, and he was back home on the Sunday or Monday morning, and not happy, I think it's fair to say. But you know, he's got over it, and but yeah, no, he was good, and I did feel sorry for him not getting to complete the tournament. But you know, he realizes as well as I do that in the grand scheme of things, it's not really that important.
As the resident greenkeeper on this panel, how do you see what's happened with this pandemic? And obviously you've implemented practices at the course, but how do you see it changing things in the longer term? Will there be a lasting legacy from this, do you think?
I think there's an opportunity for lots of things to change, actually. And I think sort of like the cleanliness side of it is one. I mean, you know, the spraying of machinery with disinfectant, it takes seconds. It really does just take a few seconds at the end of it. And I can honestly say for here at Richmond, that's something that will continue for forever. You know, it's just a good practice. It's not something we'd ever done before, but it's good practice. And, you know, having the alcohol hand gel just sitting around so you can just grab it at any opportunity. You know, we've got bottles and stuff everywhere. I think, again, it'll become good practice. On the negative side, I think some clubs with lower budgets and stuff will see it as an opportunity to shed staff, which is a real shame. You know, I think there will be redundancies out there and people out of jobs, which is a real shame. But You know, a lot of guys work really, really hard on their own or with one other member of staff to maintain a golf course. And, you know, some of the negative golf courses at clubs out there with committees and stuff will go, well, you can do it with two staff when everyone's poorly, so why can't you do it all the time? And, you know, I mean, these guys have worked themselves into the ground doing sort of like 75, 80, 90 hours a week. That's just not sustainable. And for any employer that looks at that and goes, yeah, you can do that all the time, you know, it's just wrong. So, but I say another upside to it, lots and lots of golf clubs reporting having dozens and dozens of new members. You know, golf's the only sport they can play other than tennis. So people that have been transient golfers, you know, played a couple of times a year with work and stuff, all of a sudden thinking, I'm going to go and play golf. So, you know, they've started joining golf clubs. So, you know, maybe long term it might help the industry. But we'll wait and see.
Yeah, or if you're like me, you go out for that round of golf, realise you're still crap and take up tennis. That's interesting, Les. Actually, one of the pieces of work that I think Bigger would really like to do is measuring how long it takes to do each job so you can actually quantify that workout on the course. Something I'd really like to put together. Phil, you I think we mentioned in your bio, you get involved with research trials as much as possible. How do you envision that side of things, the chemical product side of the industry changing? Do you think there'll be greater demand for some products, or do you think lower budgets mean we'll have to move towards a more natural side of things?
Good question, that, Carl. I'm not one really. Got to give me the heads up before you put me live on a webinar.
Sorry.
So I don't know. I guess what we've seen in the past couple of months is maybe greenkeepers, groundsmen almost stripping back programs or products that they use and reassessing everything. Do I need this certain product? What am I getting value-wise out of that when the pressure's been put from committed on limited spend? And I think that's probably not a bad thing. People assessing what they're using, what direction they want to go in, what product are they getting value from. In terms of the research side of things, obviously all our trials have had to be put on hold for the past couple of months while all this is going on. That's internally and externally with some of the other venues that we use, like universities. Obviously they've all been shut down, so we're kind of looking forward to getting those up and running again. Hopefully we can do with the social distancing guidelines, so looking forward to getting involved in some of that. But product wise I guess, like Les says, really, I guess every company at the minute will be researching hand sanitizers and things like that. Probably a growing market for that didn't exist before. But yeah, chemical wise, I think most people's views has always been the same way. Really, use as little as you can, but you know, they are there for when you need. So I don't envisage that changing much. I think golfers will still demand high quality surfaces. It'll be interesting, like Les says, for those clubs that maybe do take the decision to limit greenkeeping staff numbers. If they do, hopefully they don't, but if they do, I think they'll quickly find out the value of having good skilled grounds team, that they can't manage those courses like we see on Twitter at the minute. They look fantastic. Greenkeepers have almost made a rod for their own back, haven't they, a little bit, in the how good the course has been presented during that lockdown on limited staff. It shows how good those guys are, and you just hope that the members don't look at that and start thinking, well, we can do that on two, let's get, maybe not bring back the guys that are furloughed, let's hope they don't. But I think they'll quickly find that to keep those standards going forward, to sustainably maintain those standards, they're going to need a good skill team. And if memberships are growing, hopefully the tills and the bars at some point will start ringing it, and golf clubs will start monetizing these extra members, that budgets can grow, maybe not fall back. Because at the end of the day, golfers all want to play on the best facilities, but you know, you need good skilled staff and you need budgets to do so.
Brilliant. Do you see your role changing, how you actually operate your role going forwards?
Yeah, I suppose Hentges would be the same when he was in the UK doing similar to what I do. You know, you were always ringing ahead. You know, you never really cold called people. I don't think the idea of cold calling at the minute is kind of, I don't think it's comfortable with anybody. So, and we're fortunate that we work in an industry where we can social distance during meetings, you know, like whether it's in a football club pitch or whether it's out on the golf course, you know. So I don't envisage too many changes there. I think it's an interesting time right now as lockdown's being eased, what is acceptable. And I think various greenkeepers will have different valid standpoints on that. And I think it's a tricky one for us reps to make sure that we're seen as being responsible, that we're professional, that we're not taking or not seeing this as any kind of opportunity to exploit in any way. But at the same time, when you're working for a company, you want to let your customers and your end users know that you are there to help and support in whichever way we can do. So it's a real tight kind of tightrope that we're treading at the minute. And long term, I think hopefully we can get back to somewhere where we were. I think whether we'll be sat in a brew room having a cup of coffee, no, I don't think we will. I think we'll be out on the golf course, which is probably where we want to be anyway. It's where we all enjoy, you know. So yeah, hopefully we can. It's not too different from where we were.
Brilliant, Jez. Would you have anything to add to that?
No, I think quite similar. I think Phil's hit a lot of it on the head. Yes, we've seen an increase as the industry has in biological products, you know, and obviously that's what we're known for. And I think with some of the issues of, you know, like you were saying about chemicals and different things changing, this has probably now put another strain on people with the finances and everything else, so that they will be looking at alternatives and, you know, maybe using what's out there, biological, and, you know, what you can do with the ground naturally, may have to, you know, be used a lot more with some of these that are having their budgets reduced. But as Phil said, as a company, yes, you're working for a company, you respect them all, you know, what they do. They have had a difficult time. You know, we can't go chasing, calling. We're there if they need us, you know, and we'll keep in touch with them and help when we can. But, you know, the nature of where we're at the moment means that we've got to be a supporting role, as well as doing our own job for the company we work for. You know, and hopefully we've got a good enough relationship with the people we deal with that, you know, they can appreciate that and they can respect us as much as we respect them as well. So.
Brilliant.
Tough time all around. No matter what you're involved in, we're all sort of having to learn, you know, new skills and come through it all together.
Yeah. Now, I will say to our audience that I've just got a couple of questions left. So, if you do have anything that you'd like to ask any of our panel, please do type it in the chat box, and I'll see what I can do to read them out. Jez, I'm just going to stick with you a second though, sir. You mentioned you had the machine because you didn't have a particularly fantastic lifestyle with the smoking, etc. Is there a message that you've got to other green cubes, etc., about lifestyle and how that impacted you?
Yeah, I don't think I'm not going to preach to anyone. Yes, I stopped smoking 3 years ago, which again the doctor said could have helped me a lot. You know, but I did smoke heavily for 30 years before that. We all know greenkeeping is a great job. It's a physical job. You're out there doing, you know, work, and it does help you, you know. But I was still overweight, you know, still classed as type 2 diabetes and overweight and a little bit of blood pressure. And I'll be the first to admit that when this came about, similar to what Phil said, I am 50, although, you know, you seem to forget your age or you don't feel your age. And I ticked a few boxes for, you know, for this disease, which at the time I didn't think. I thought it's older people and it's a bit like the flu. So to be struck down the way I was a shock. But then obviously speaking with the doctors, you know, the conditions I had was sort of the ones that would add to it. And the fact that I used to be a heavy smoker was probably why I suffered a bit more with the respiratory problems than someone who's a bit fitter like Les or Phil, you know. So I think that's the biggest thing from this, you know, even just three of us here, a lot of similarities but so much differences as well, you know, and I think that's the thing. It affects so many people in so many different ways. But yeah, if I can keep the weight off that I lost while I wasn't well, I can build myself up on my bike and do a bit more. The job is less physical now that I do than what I used to do. So that doesn't help. But I've got to make time for me to keep my health as good as I can.
Good on you. No link implied, but I'm going to go to Les now. So healthy lifestyles. You're back on a committee now for Bigger. And I just wondered if you could maybe give us a bit of an insight into the committee structure at Bigger, what you've been doing during this period since you've recovered, and how members might be able to use that to get a little bit of support and help if they, you know, if they do know, if they do have some questions about Worst Turn.
Yeah, I must admit, there's a Surrey section. We haven't done anything because we discussed it. Someone said, "Oh, maybe we should have a Zoom meeting," and I was like, "I've had far too many meetings in the last few weeks where we've been talking about what ifs and maybes and what if Boris says this and what if Boris says that," and I just can't be doing with it. So I said, "Look, at the minute we're taking our information from headquarters, you know, on." So like, you know, what greenkeepers can and can't do or should and shouldn't do. And, you know, all the information that's come out from, you know, from you and Jim and everyone else at HQ has been fantastic. And I, you know, as a chairman of the Surrey section, it's like, we don't need someone else's opinion or thoughts or interpretation being given out. It's like one message, one organisation. So we haven't done anything, but, you know, as things start to change in the next couple of weeks, we'll probably get us like a Zoom meeting or a, you know, a call chat and we'll have to start thinking about what we can do. You know, I mean, these webinars have been on every week. You know, some I've listened to some I haven't bothered with because I've been doing stuff. But, you know, it's been fantastic. It's been a really good thing for people to get involved in. So yeah, but I mean, you know, I think with the network and greenkeeping the way it is, people always know, you know, sort of like someone that they can turn to. And, you know, I've had a lot of phone calls. I've had amazing support, actually, people phoning me and saying, "Wow, you know, I didn't know you were ill and how you're feeling better." And a few people that knew early on that I'd been ill were literally sending me messages almost daily, like, "Hope you're feeling better. If you need anything, let us know." You know, so the greenkeeping family, so to speak. I know it sounds a cheesy cliche, but, you know, we are a family, and that sort of like support network has been there for me, lots of support. But then I've also had people phoning me and asking me questions about, you know, sanitizers and, you know, practices and stuff like that. So, you know, so the network's still been there, and it always will be in greenkeeping.
Brilliant. That's good to hear. Okay, we do have a question. Thank you, Ellie, for sending this one over to us. She says, "It's great that you've all recovered and any of you guys can jump in and answer this. What changes, if any, will you make in your lives as a result of your experience?" Phil, will you make any changes to your life as a result?
I don't know. I think since it's happened, we all live our lives about 100 miles an hour. We're all got not enough hours in the day, have we, it feels at times. And that week when I was down and I was kind of wondering whether my mum and dad were going to maybe get it, I think that kind of big wake-up call, kind of like, you know, let's get the work-life balance maybe a little bit better. So hopefully I can maintain that a bit better. Probably do a lot more of these webinars. I think it's about time that we embrace some of the technology that's been out there for quite a while to make us a bit more efficient at what we're doing, to maybe help with the work-life balance. So that's probably my take home from all of it, is just kind of just to appreciate everything that we have. I know, again, it's another cliche, isn't it, but it's so true.
You're right about the digital side of things. Biggest continue to learn that happens every January, we film that. And for years, those videos have sat on our website and nobody's ever touched them because we didn't know they were there. Bigger really hasn't exploited this online resource. But like Les says, we've been doing these webinars at least twice a week now and on a huge range of topics. And I really hope that our members have stayed engaged as a result of that. It's been great to be able to do that for them. Jez, any changes to your lifestyle?
Well, I think obviously I'm just popping over the other side of 5-0 now, so I've got to bear that in mind. Obviously, the job I do now is less physical than what I was. So yeah, similar to Phil, making time really a little bit family time, but B, time for me. You know, I go out most mornings now on my bike. You know, and I wouldn't do that when I'm normally working flat out or whether I'm away. But I think I've got to make the effort to do these things. And you know, I've had a scare. I've probably been very lucky. You know, I kicked the smoking habit to see if I can just get a little bit fitter, you know, and maybe not eat quite so many crisps, cakes and pasties.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Les, should we finish with you?
Yeah, I mean, you sort of like mentioned the work-life balance. And, you know, I mean, I've been back at work, what, 6-7 weeks now? And because there's been no competitions on at work, There's been, obviously it was shut for 6 weeks where there was no golfers at all. So actually going into work at 6:30, going home at 2:30 in the afternoon and not having the phone calls, you know, there was no disrespect to the guys, but no company reps phoning me going, are you around for a chat and stuff like that? And, you know, there's none of this, my buggy's broken down, can you go and pick? There's always something. And so that I really sort of like got into this spending more time at home. Obviously, the kids have been homeschooling. My wife's not been working because she worked in a nursery. So, you know, we've spent a lot more time as a family, and they might not agree with me, but I've actually really enjoyed it. I've enjoyed spending time with them, and we've, you know, the weather's been amazing, so we've done some work in the garden and what have you. So I think going forward, I would really like to continue spending quality time really with, you know, with my wife and my two kids, and doing stuff together and having a bit of a laugh really with them, and instead of it all being rushing around like a headless chicken trying to do stuff. So it's been an eye opener.
I think that is an excellent point to bring this webinar to a close. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining me and sharing your stories. I've really enjoyed it. I hope everybody listening has as well. So everybody at home, I hope you have enjoyed today's webinar. This webinar will be available in the members area of the Bigger website within the next few hours. So I'm certainly going to revisit it to listen to the bit that I've missed there at the end. And it'll sit there for some time to come, as will all the Continue to Learn Extra webinars that we've done over this period. There's a growing resource there, and I really hope you do check it out. It's fantastic. Thank you once again for joining us. Thank you, gentlemen. We do hope that you'll join us again soon. For future details of Continue to Learn Extra webinars and everything else that Bigger's offering, please visit the WhatsApp page of the Bigger website. And thank you very much, gents. Cheers.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.